The school at Juyuan is a pile of rubble and twisted metal. There are thought to be more than 1,000 children here trapped under the wreckage. Hundreds of distraught relatives are crowded round the entrance, waiting for news.
That was a couple of days after last week's earthquake, and even today a woman was pulled after 195 hours from the rubble of a building. These are the kind of human stories that inevitably compel in the days following any natural disaster. But there's a much bigger issue at stake here. Everybody now knows that wars can precipitate massive social change. But are there occasions when natural disasters play that role? From the Lisbon earthquake to Mexico in 1985, often cited as a turning point in the country's path towards multi-party democracy. And when is it the case that disasters slow down or even reverse social progress? Well, joining me to discuss these issues, historical geographer Richard Hamlin and Alparslan Ozadem, co-author of Disaster Management and Civil Society, who joins me down the line from York. We just heard, Richard, a clip from China. Do you think the conditions in China at present are there to help precipitate social change?
Well, I think we can be very impressed by the Chinese disaster response. We should be, and it's extraordinary, the images that we're seeing of thousands of orange-clad disaster relief professionals, clearly trained to a high level, swarming down the mountainsides and pulling people from those buildings. But we also need to remember that most of the buildings that fell were new buildings. They should not have fallen. And there's a long and difficult history behind China of kickbacks and corruptions in the construction trade, and this is particularly true outside the major cities.
Alp, I mean, what Richard's in effect suggesting is that the corruption, the incompetence of these buildings are some of the ingredients that need to be there in order for a disaster to turn into a moment of social change. If we take Burma, do you think the Burma situation is such with the cyclone that there are real possibilities of change following upon this?
Yes, I think that is the case for a number of reasons. In recent history, in a number of countries, natural disasters had major impacts in terms of state-civil society relationships. And I think this may also be the case for Burma.
Richard, if we now let a whiff of history into this, this isn't something new after all. There's the terrifying earthquake of Lisbon. Did political and social change follow that?
It did, but in all sorts of complicated ways. And the earthquake left the people of Portugal, particularly the people of Lisbon, in a state of helpless incredulity. And it really allowed a strong leader in the shape of the Marquis of Pombal to come in and take sole control of the reins of government, which he did. And he was, on the whole, a reforming leader, but he became increasingly despotic. So the earthquake, in a way, paved the way for Europe's first modern dictator.
There is a way, Alp, in what Rich has just said, is that despotism can follow, and that despotism can curiously be progressive.
Well, that may be the case, but when we look at more recent cases like the 1995 Kobe earthquake in Japan, 1999 Marmara earthquake in Turkey, what we see is that because the state was so unprepared to respond to such earthquake disasters, actually the image of the state as provider, as a paternalistic figure, collapsed spectacularly. So in that way, I think such disasters are very significant in the way the state is perceived by society in general, and also in terms of its relationship with civil society organizations. So this is why I argue that I think in the case of Burma, and to some extent in the case of China, we may experience similar changes.
Richard, I mean, if you pick up on what Alp said, the notion that the image of the state can be terminally damaged by these disasters, can you try and sketch for us what are the conditions that you need, as it were, for a disaster to turn into something good rather than something simply terrifying?
Well, I think you need some form of long-term mitigation technology put in place after the disaster. Otherwise,
can you give us an example of what you mean by that?
Well, for example, Bangladesh is a very good example of, it's extremely poor but extremely enlightened and progressive government, a democratic government, and they have made huge national forests down in the Ganges Delta, mangrove swamps, natural barriers against cyclones. Now, Cyclone Nargis was nothing like as strong as Cyclone Sidr last November, which hit Bangladesh. Very few casualties in Bangladesh because the government had evacuated more than 2 million people, one of the largest evacuations in human history. And they'd also left this magnificent mangrove swamp, 6,000 square kilometres in place. It's now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Burma, by contrast, has stripped all of the mangrove, almost all of the mangrove, out of the Irrawaddy Delta for rice plantation. Now, rice plantations are just invite cyclones to sweep inland and destroy farming way inland where cyclones should never be.
To put it very simply then, and I suppose I want to push this to you, Alp, it's in a state's interest to produce kind of disaster-proven solutions in order that after the disaster, or actually before the disaster, they can protect themselves by protecting the people.
Well, it would be definitely in the interest of the state, but the problem is that in the neoliberal economics, the states don't prioritize disaster management, disaster preparedness as a priority. So in many cases, when disaster happens, they find themselves rather inadequate in their response. Let me give you the example of the Marmara earthquake, for example. What happened there, for the state to reach the earthquake-affected area, it took more than 3 days, and I'm talking about 90 kilometers from Istanbul. So in that way, it was so clear that while civil society organizations were so effective in responding to the disaster, the state simply couldn't do much. So in that way, I think it brings so much self-esteem to civil society organizations, showing that what they could do in terms of response and also the coordination of their own activities, making them an important player in disaster management.
Of course, one of the things... Sorry, Richard.
But Alp, even in the most wealthy and technologically advanced civilization on Earth, namely the United States, it didn't take them 3 days to get to New Orleans. It took them 3 weeks. I mean, what hope is there for a nation such as Turkey when it takes President Bush 3 weeks to federalize the National Guard?
But I suppose I want to ask, because both of you have been kind of quite upbeat about this. The truth is, I would have thought in a devastated zone that the chance of political change is minimised simply because the people actually are having to spend 24 hours a day just surviving. Richard and then Al?
Yes, certainly. One of the impacts is... One of the consequences is a demoralisation of the people. So, of course, but out of that can come a desire for political change. But that could be years, decades ahead. You mentioned at the top of the piece the 1985 Mexico City earthquake, and that's often been credited as bringing in multi-party elections to Mexico City. And the impact really was on a local level. It was on local government. It wasn't on national government. And this was about groups of urban solidarity coming together who I suspect were there all along, and this gave it a kind of a catalyst.
Well then, I mean, let me just be the sceptical one here, Alp. It's very difficult to establish cause and effect, isn't it? Isn't that the problem?
Well, that is difficult, but I think we can argue that this process can be taken further if there are a number of other factors, like the involvement of the media and the involvement of the international community in the process. With the anger from the public for the inadequacies of the state, there tends to be huge pressure on the state as an actor to take more proactive action and deal with the shortcomings in disaster management. And for example, in Japan and in Turkey, in Gujarat, India, they all changed their disaster law, they changed their NGO law. I mean, that's really significant, bringing many more conducive environment for the work of NGOs. So in that way, I think what we see that at least in the short term, the state is prepared to share the governance of disaster management with civil society organizations.
I understand that, but I suppose I want to clarify something. Richard. Alps just mentioned the important role of the media, particularly in modern disasters. Is it the external media or the domestic media that matters most? Because after all, both in Burma and China, the media is very tightly controlled.
Yes, I mean, I think the reason the international media is interested in this cyclone in Burma is because it was so badly managed, so badly handled, but also the backstory of the ongoing democracy movement and the riots and the demonstrations from last year. I mean, for example, there was Cyclone Mala hit Burma in 2006. We heard nothing about that in the international media. And strangely enough, the Burmese authorities reacted to that rather well. I mean, they gave 3 days of warnings and they evacuated 50,000 people. So the total casualties from that was something like 22 people. Now, the response to Nargis is terrible, even by Burmese standards.
Alp?
Just to add to that point, I think national media is even more significant. And this is why I'm slightly skeptical about the whether or not that will be a social change in China and Burma, because they don't have a very strong independent media, national media. Because in the case of Turkey, for example, it was media which made the whole issue running months after the disaster, which put huge pressure on the state to take more effective action.
I wonder if I could ask you both, because I was in China last week when the earthquake happened and I watched some of the television coverage, even though my Mandarin's very bad. Is it perfectly possible to claim in societies where the media is controlled, actually disasters will solidify the power of authorities? Because Hu Jintao and Wen Jianbao went down there to Sichuan.
Yes, I mean, this kind of wall-to-wall footage of Grandpa Wen clambering among the ruins, being there himself, pulling people out himself, that's incredibly powerful. And people on the ground are saying, even in the most devastated areas, well, Grandpa Wen was here. And that's something that echoes back from Pombal, that one of...
So Pombal was...
Pombal, after the Lisbon earthquake, had images of himself made, clambering among the ruins, and these great stories of how Pombal saved the city. And clearly Wen Jiabao, with his trademark anorak, is hoping for the same kind of iconic status as being the saviour of the earthquake zone.
Thank you very much to Richard Hamblin and to Alparslan Ozodem. Last week, I was in Beijing and visited the studio of an artist whose father was exiled by Mao Zedong more than 40 years ago. On the table were two biographies of the former leader. Next week, in Hong Kong, one of Andy Warhol's most famous paintings of Mao Zedong will be sold at auction with a great deal of fanfare. Political icon, style icon. Mao may have died in 1976, but both within China and outside, he remains troublingly alive and kicking. Night Waves explores the strange afterlife of one of the most important figures in 20th century history, with David Mack, an artist who's worked with the image of Mao, and Jonathan Fenby, author of the forthcoming Penguin History of Modern China.
There are very few icons. Mao's a huge one. Marilyn Monroe's a huge one. People, you know, people would know these faces all over the world, you know. It fascinates me that you can be here in Forest Hill and you can see a kid walking down the street with an image of Mao on his T-shirt. And probably never... That kid would probably not know anything about this character at all, you know.
Probably a lot of people who have Che Guevara T-shirts have very little idea of what Che Guevara did or so on. And Mao is just somehow, he's gone into an iconography. Ah, that's a Mao T-shirt, which has very, very little, if any, relationship with the reality of who he actually was and what actually happened under him. It's an example, I think, of that kind of iconography, which I'm sure you've got throughout religious history, being divorced from the reality of what happened.
The idea of having Mao on your wall is kind of strange, isn't it? You know, because usually people who would collect art are going to be quite liberal. There'll be a liberal bunch of guys, and they may be very right on. They'll be into, you know, human rights and you name it. But there you go, you can actually have this terrible dictator, you know, above your mantelpiece.
If you take the basic fact that Mao killed was responsible for the deaths of who knows how many, 60 million people. You can take figures as you wish there. It is extraordinary that indeed he should be on T-shirts, that you should have, for instance, I came across a restaurant in Melbourne a little while ago, which is dedicated entirely to Mao and Mao pictures and Mao dishes, that you have figures of Mao being sold all over the place. I mean, you wouldn't think of doing that for Hitler.
I made this series of work called M&M's, Marilyn and Mao, Mao and Marilyn.
David Mack's M&M series uses two very different icons, Marilyn Monroe and Mao Zedong.
So I'd make Mao out of Marilyn and I'd make Marilyn out of Mao, and what I'll do is I'll buy like thousands of postcards, 2,000-3,000 postcards of Mao, produce a photograph of Marilyn, lace that over the top of it, slice it all up, move it around, jiggle it about, and you end up with this kind of a double image. I must have sold maybe 30, 40 images of Mao over the last 3 or 4 years. Strangely enough, a lot of them are in the Far East, they're in China, they're in Hong Kong, they're in places like that. And maybe that's why they buy them. Maybe there's a sort of revenge involved in that with the people who buy these things. Maybe it's not just a straightforward, oh, I like the look of that, let's stick it up in the wall, you know? But also it's part of your history. There is a kind of revenge involved in that, where you sort of turn him, you flip him upside down on his back, and he becomes a kind of, you know, tortoise struggling to move.
The popularity of David Mack's Mao images is part of something much bigger, according to Jonathan Femby, and he thinks it has little to do with an ironic take on a brutal dictator.
Well, certainly in Hong Kong, there's a kind of Mao image industry there, from smart clubs and restaurants in Hong Kong down to a little shop there which just churns out fake reproductions of Cultural Revolution statues and so on. And people buy these, and it's become a kind of, it's a chic there. And in China itself, I think, you know, a lot of people still, older people, particularly those who have lost out in the economic reform of the last 30 years, look back to the Mao era as if it was some kind of golden age. I mean, as you get in Russia, similarly with the Stalinist age. I feel uncomfortable myself when I see the Mao iconography. I mean, when it's very well done. I mean, some of the images, I say, and actually more some of the Chinese images from the time than perhaps the Warhol, I admire them as art. That I see as a bit of, you know, it's almost a bit of history, political history. But when it is the T-shirt or the Mao effigies being sold as a chic thing to have on your mantelpiece and so on, I do feel myself quite uncomfortable with that, given what the man actually did.
Does David Mack share Jonathan Femby's worries?
I think when you've got an icon, it becomes something else. Something else kicks in there. The people who are concerned about the past of those, if it's a terrible despot or a film star or whatever, I think that's another kind of consideration. For me, I'm interested in the kind of recognition factor, if you like. And I use it a lot in my work and with other things. I mean, I'll pick materials that everybody knows. I'll make sculpture with coat hangers. I don't have to explain to somebody what a coat hanger is. It's a kind of known thing. It's a kind of language. You're dipping into an area that can actually become quite unsavoury, if you like. Hitler would be an icon, I guess. You know, am I going to use that? I'm going to draw the line at something like that. Mao seems, he's further away. Weirdly, here's this incredibly recognisable image. But somehow the kind of politics or the morality or whatever you're going to get involved in there, it's further away from you. I mean, I'm aware of the history and things, and I'll read about it and stuff, but there's a line I'm prepared to cross to use that image. You do draw lines, you know. I mean, for instance, there was an artist who, you remember all the fuss about it, the Myra Hindley image that appeared at the Sensation Show, you know, a few years ago. And I would draw the line there. There was something wrong with that for me, because there's an artist, the image was great and so on, but the people are still alive who are kind of, and they're closer to home, if you like.
However discomforting it may be, Jonathan Femby suggests that Mao's own management of his image may be part of the reason his image is still current, still resonant.
I think he was very aware of his image. I mean, if you look back, I know he had photographers, he had people arranging the equivalent of, you know, PR people, if you like, arranging it. But I think, and if you look back again and you read back, right from a very early stage, he was intensely self-aware. Despite the big biography of Mao that came out a couple of years ago from Jung Chan, which of course attracted a lot of attention, for a lot of people, Mao is still not seen as a monster. He's somehow in a different category. And, of course, the fact that his image still beams out over Tiananmen Square in Beijing is part of that. It's partly that, let's say, he had some very good art done around him, or art that makes a very good popular impact. And that is not just the T-shirts. If you go back to posters made in 1949, in the early years of the People's Republic, they are very good to look at. They are very striking images, and at the middle, there is the chairman. I think there is also a feeling still in China and in parts of Asia, certainly, that Mao was the man who, in the phrase he used, allowed China to stand up, that this was China asserting itself. Mao was accepted during his lifetime abroad as this kind of heroic figure, and everybody, although people could have guessed, and I mean some knew obviously what was going on, the horrors that went on in Maoist China were never really, as it were, taken seriously, but they were really not taken on board, I don't think, in the public consciousness. And that applied to people like Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, who played up to Mao in a quite extraordinary way when you read the record there. And it was as if he really was an emperor, and everybody was kowtowing in front of him and wishing for his favour. And of course, he made the most of this, even when he was in his dotage. And all that created a situation where the reality of Mao mattered less and less.
Jonathan suggests that it's not just Mao Zedong that the West is enthralled by, but earlier Chinese emperors.
What is interesting is the great success of the First Emperor exhibition and the Terracotta Warriors at the British Museum, which was a great exhibition. It was very well done and so on. Very interesting, very good to look at and so on. But I had the kind of underlying question there. You know, the First Emperor, he was a kind of Mao of his time, and ruthless, killing how many people you don't know and so on, complete authoritarianism, legalism, one-party rule, autocracy and so on. And again, I mean, I loved the exhibition. It was tremendous. But I felt slightly coming out of it, well, you know, have I been, in a sense, celebrating another of history's great despots and murderers?
Jonathan Fenby. You also heard the artist David Mack. You're listening to Night Waves with me, Philip Dodd. And if you want to listen again to this programme or to any of the last four, just please log on to bbc.co.uk/radio3. The historian Tony Judd, British-born but US resident, is probably best known for his combative and very critical accounts of Israel, accounts made hardly less palatable by the fact that he speaks from within the Jewish community. Israel's an important subject in his new collection of essays, which has the self-explanatory title, Reappraisals, Reflections on the Forgotten 20th Century. But at the book's heart is a set of reviews and essays which centre on Europe and the US. In this new book, he accuses us all, but primarily the political elites, of a catastrophic amnesia about what happened between 1945 and 1989. And he does this partly by focusing on the role of public intellectuals during that period. The last section's devoted to his adopted country, the US, which he castigates, much preferring the European social democratic model against the market US one. I spoke to him earlier today down the line from New York. His book, I suggested to him, wanted to challenge those who say that the world of post-1989 is a new world and has nothing at all to learn from the post-war period.
You're certainly right in that. It's not so much that things didn't change hugely after 1989. Of course they did. But a lot of things didn't change in the ways that we find it comfortable to think they did, and a lot of other things got forgotten as a consequence of the change.
One of the things that you think's been both forgotten, actually forgotten is probably not a good word, has been dismissed, is the role of the intellectuals, and inevitably intellectuals did play a great and major part in post-war, Cold War politics. Do you think there was something distinctive about their role during that period?
Well, obviously, it depends a little bit on where you look. The role of intellectuals had always been much more important in France, let's say, or in Italy, or in Eastern Europe for slightly different reasons, whereas in countries like Britain or the United States, they're much more marginal to political conversation and public debate. But the crucial point about the Cold War era, I suppose, is that the fundamental dividing line between East and West, or capitalism and communism, or freedom and oppression, or however you want to define it, was a line which was very recognizable in intellectual terms and could be talked about in both in the abstract and in moral terms, as well as in public policy terms. And that's something which gave intellectuals a certain space in which to talk about issues of policy, whereas today, policy tends to be talked about largely, at any rate in this country, here in the United States, largely in terms either of economic interest or great power reality issues. And those are not fields in which intellectuals are either as well informed or as competent to talk.
The role of intellectuals in these different places, in America, in Western Europe, and in Eastern Europe, were very different. Do you think the issue of who intellectuals represented during that period is an important thing that we need to think about now?
Yes, I do. I think there are two senses in which intellectuals played a role in those years, and indeed had played a role really since the early 20th century. And in both senses, we've now lost touch with it. The first is, if you like, that intellectuals, particularly in places where they lived close to and had access to debates about power and politics, intellectuals were taken to represent, very often in countries where no one else could represent, the interests of people at large. In countries like Poland or in Czechoslovakia or in Hungary, it was presumed that poets or playwrights or philosophers would speak for, did speak for, could speak for a silent people. The difference now, of course, is that exactly in those countries, the things that moved intellectuals, ethical debates, grand visions of better societies, debates about the proper role and use of the state and so on, have disappeared with the post-Cold War concern with prosperity and the market and privatization and so forth. The other way in which intellectuals have disappeared from our radar is that the intellectual typically was someone who wrote. And it was the rise and fall of the written media and the rise and fall of a literate mass public interested in reading from largely the 1880s until the 1970s, which was also the determining period of the rise and fall of the intellectual. Intellectuals don't function as well on television or, forgive me, on radio because of the requirement for brevity and for sound bites and so on, and also because the market is now split up among radio and television and internet and different media, and there is no longer a common community listening to that community's intellectuals.
As I listen to you, I feel there's an immense pull in you back towards that early period. It's as if this book, Reappraisals, is an elegy for a world that's passed away and for the role of intellectuals that have passed away.
I think there's something in that. I mean, I like to think that I'm not nostalgic, although it's true that almost anyone in my generation, I recently turned 60, probably is nostalgic despite themselves in many ways. But I'm selectively nostalgic, if that's an acceptable excuse. And that is to say, I think, obviously, that many intellectuals, Jean-Paul Sartre comes to mind, played a less than admirable role in the post-war years, very often apologizing for repressive regimes or apologizing or justifying violence and so on. But the fact is, nonetheless, that in the public space, whether it was newspapers or magazines, or widely read small books and essays in the public space of Western Europe and in the desk drawers of Eastern Europe because you couldn't publish. And even in New York City, where I live, there was a world of people who took ideas seriously, sometimes too seriously, and sometimes naively, and in doing so made ideas about society, about the role of the state, about the purposes of public life and collective action, made ideas seem important. And nowadays those ideas do not seem important in many places, and I think that's a loss.
You save your fiercest criticism for the intellectuals of the left who, in your view, didn't speak out against what was happening in, say, the Soviet Union. It seems to me another part of the project of this book, in a sense, is, and you're an avowed man of the left, is to rescue the politics of the left from its association with communism.
No, I think that's a very perceptive remark, if you'll allow me. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think of myself as coming out of, well, I know I come out of the European social democratic left, both in England and then via an older tradition in Central Europe. But the pollution of that left by its perfectly understandable association historically with the authoritarian left, the totalitarian left, with Stalin and Stalinism, and the apologists for Stalin and Stalinism among Western European intellectuals, that pollution is part of the reason why the left today doesn't have an identifiable project, an identifiable language, an identifiable location on the political spectrum. Because in throwing out the bathwater of the oppressive state, we've also thrown out the baby of the activist social welfare state of the post-war years. And I think somehow, if there is to be any recovery from this collapse of radical political project in the last years of the 20th century, somehow we have to go back beyond and through the communist catastrophe to discover what it was about the 20th century left which is still worth saving and trying to push forward. And we can't do that unless we tell the truth about what happened in between.
Let's move to the second part of your discussion. If intellectuals is one, the other thing you're trying to do is a wonderfully anachronistic aim, or it may be anachronistic, which is to rescue the state, which from Thatcher onwards across Europe and, of course, across North America with Reagan, the state was seen as the bad. To quote Orwell again, it was as if the state, you know, the state was just bad, bad, and bad. You want to kind of rescue it and say the 21st century needs a state in order to adjudicate between power within a culture.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think I want to do two things which are connected. One, wearing my historian's hat, to point out the reason we had the activist states of the 20th century, particularly the second half of the 20th century, is not because of some momentary success of socialism in the post-45 years, but because of the catastrophic loss of security and safety in the early 20th century because of war and economic depression, meaning that the state became the sort of security net by which society could be stabilized again. And the welfare state was really a means to prevent a return into the disasters of fascism and the depression. So we need to understand that if we are to understand why the state came into being as an active presence in our lives, not as an ideological project, but as a sort of prophylactic project, a safety against something else. And that brings us to the 21st century, because what I fear we are entering now, and I do write this in the book, is an age of insecurity, an age of fear, obviously an age of physical fear, the fear of terrorism and of terrorist attacks, but also economic insecurity, fear that outsiders or outside economic competition will overwhelm us, and fear that the state will be unable to protect us against these global forces, whether they're material or economic or physical or whatever. And we are going to need something like the welfare state, for want of a better shorthand, to protect us against the demagogic state, which is the alternative that is going to arise as people turn to the state for protection against foreigners, against minorities, against threats perceived to come from those people. And the alternative in the 21st century, in my view, is not the globalized post-state world versus the old-fashioned world of the nation state. It's the protective welfare state, democratic and open, against the demagogic closed state of fear.
But your book takes us to you and Israel, where you've got yourself into a whole set of hot water in America, but you're very clear when you, because you've claimed, you've argued for a one-state secular solution, is you're very clear that Israel public opinion is actually much more nuanced than American public opinion on these issues.
Well, it would be very difficult to be less nuanced than American public opinion. Although, to be fair to American public opinion, the real problem is American political conversation. Because when you look at opinion polls taken on the Middle East issue, people on the whole in the States are quite moderate, so long as you don't ask them head on, do you believe Israel should be obliterated? And then they will say no, of course. But otherwise, they will say they wish there were two states and they wish that there was a peaceful solution. And yes, the 67 borders, if they know about them, are the best answer, and so on. The problem in America, of course, is Congress and the lobbying power of a small subsection of official Jewish organizations. And there, it's very different from Israel. In Israel, I can talk to people and be talked to by people and be criticized and approved in Israel for my views in ways that never happen in the States.
As I read this book and moved through the essays on intellectuals to the section on Israel, I thought that in certain ways you too are an example of what you were describing, the East End Jewish boy who ends up in New York writing about Israel. Do you see yourself in that cosmopolitan tradition?
Oh, God, no. I hate that description of it. I mean, every little bit of it seems, of the description, ties me down to a single identity. East End Jewish boy ends up in New York writing about Israel. I didn't write about Israel, even though I had spent time there in the 60s. I didn't start writing about it until the early 21st century, when I realized that precisely because I had a certain public visibility and being Jewish was covered, I could write critically about Israel and try to open a conversation that many people were reluctant to have here.
There's something in a Brecht poem where he says, you know, the people have disappointed me, let's elect a new people. You're endlessly disappointed by your constituencies.
Well, I'm not disappointed by the people, I suppose, partly because I don't pretend that I have a mass popular constituency. I'm a historian who occasionally writes in magazines read by a few hundred thousand intellectuals like me. But I am disappointed in, well, not disappointed, it's not quite the word. I am worried about what has happened to the United States. I'm not disappointed by Europe. I think that Europe is letting itself down by failing to act on the largest stage in the world. But I think the European achievement since the 1940s is quite remarkable, so remarkable indeed that we've forgotten how remarkable it is because we live in it as though it were normal. But the United States is a country in a state of incipient cultural as well as economic and political decline. That's one of the reasons why the Obama moment is so important for young people, because they realize this. And in that sense, yes, it's a disappointment.
Tony Judd, and his book, Reappraisals, Reflections on the Forgotten 20th Century, is published by Heinemann. A woman died this month, with a name unlikely to resonate with many of us. Yet what she did in her private life and the consequences of that act did more to precipitate social change in America in the 1960s than many more public acts by much better known names. Rupert Cornwall on the life and times of Mildred Loving.
You've probably never heard of Mildred Loving. She wasn't a household name like Martin Luther King. She wasn't a quarter as well known as Rosa Parks, the black seamstress who refused to give up her whites-only seat in a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. But in her quiet way, she too was a heroine of the fight for civil rights in America. In June 1958, she married a white man and set up home with him in their native Virginia. A few weeks later, the sheriff and his deputies broke into their bedroom at 2 o'clock in the morning and arrested them. Mildred and Richard Loving's crime was to have violated Virginia's law against mixed marriages, dating back to the colonial era and the times of slavery. They were convicted and sentenced to a year in jail. The sentence was suspended on condition the couple didn't return to Virginia together for the next 25 years. The local judge who presided over the trial issued a ruling that although it came just half a century ago, might have been part of prehistory. Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents, Judge Leon Basile thundered. God did not intend the races to mix, and but for the interference with his arrangements, there would be no cause for such marriages. The judge was not alone in his views. At the time, 24 states maintained similar laws, despite the growing civil rights movement. In 1954, in the Brown versus Board of Education case, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered an end to segregated schools. A decade later, President Lyndon Johnson drove groundbreaking legislation through Congress, outlawing racial discrimination in a host of fields. But one bedrock of Jim Crow society remained untouched: America's anti-miscegenation laws. At which point, enter Mildred Loving. She was, by all accounts, a gentle and non-confrontational woman who never set out to be an activist. Originally, the Lovings had pleaded guilty to their technical crime and accepted exile. But Mildred soon realized she couldn't stand being forced to choose between abandoning either the man she loved and had married or her family and friends and her roots in rural Virginia. Emboldened by the impact of Martin Luther King, in 1963 she wrote to Robert Kennedy, brother of the president and the attorney general at the time, to protest her plight. At Robert Kennedy's suggestion, the American Civil Liberties Union took up her case. After a series of appeals through the lower courts, it ended up in the Supreme Court itself. The case was at one level complicated, but at another very simple. As simple as the title on the Supreme Court's docket, The Commonwealth of Virginia versus Loving. In 1967, the highest court in the land ruled unanimously in Mildred Loving's favor and overturned every state law against mixed marriages. Marriage, wrote the Chief Justice Earl Warren, is one of the basic civil rights of man, fundamental to our very existence and survival. Fate, however, would deprive the Lovings of a long and happy married life. They did return to Virginia, but in 1975, Richard was killed by a drunk driver in a road accident. But Mildred Loving's legacy is everywhere. Today, there are more than 2.5 million mixed marriages in the U.S. The majority, according to the most recent national census, are between whites and Hispanics. But the figure includes almost 300,000 marriages between blacks and whites, as well as black and Asian marriages, like the one that produced the golfer Tiger Woods. And then, of course, there's Barack Obama, the son of a Kenyan father and a white mother from Kansas. Born in 1961, Obama is the first African American to have a real chance of being elected President of the United States, the most powerful job in the world. It's a sobering thought that at the time Obama's parents married, their union would have been illegal in half the country. That it is no longer so, we have Mildred Loving to thank.
Rupert Cornwall on the life of Mildred Loving. That's all from this evening's Nightwaves, I'm afraid, but do join us tomorrow when Robert Kagan, foreign policy advisor to John McCain, will talk about his new book, The Return of History and the End of Dreams. And there'll be a review of a new production of Rosaholm, one of the great plays of Ibsen. Join us for Nightwaves tomorrow at 9:45 here on BBC Radio 3.
Nightwaves was presented by Philip Dodd and produced by Emma Thomas.